That's right. We win. Thank y'all so much for tuning in to the Ladyland Live Inspirational Show right here on WEFT 90.1 FM on your radio dial. I love you and appreciate you. God bless you.
And concise.
This is Community Media, WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Welcome to News from Neptune, the radio edit. In my absence, I have prepared a program, sort of a traditional for the 4th of July weekend, where I look at, or we can look at alternate views of the U.S. Revolution. Gerald Horn, controversial historian, very prolific. Most recent thing I played by him was about boxing and corruption. But I'm going back into the archives to seek out something after his two books, Negro Comrades of the Crown and Revolution, and controversially called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. All right, I'm going to kick it off, though. He has a, as yet, untitled book, as far as I can tell. He doesn't mention the title. And it's centered on the end of the Civil War, has implications for Juneteenth. In fact, part of the special that Pacifica did on mostly East Coast broadcasters of Pacifica on Juneteenth includes a segment with him. Be looking for something with Mitch Jezerich of Letters in Politics when the new book is more established. It's COVID delayed, of course. So I commend this to your attention. It is indeed very controversial. I've got two segments from two sources on the his latest preoccupation, of which there are many. And I put them on bookends of the earlier piece, which is centered on the two books that I mentioned. I know the title of. So thanks for your attention. Gerald Horn with an E, if you want to look through his work.
At the African American Civil War Museum here in DC, Harry hammered home the point that the Emancipation Proclamation signed by President Abraham Lincoln had to be fought for, and that African-American soldiers fighting for their own freedom were pivotal to that victory, including that final victory in Texas. And now I'm joined by on-the-grounds geopolitical analyst, Professor Gerald Horn, who has some new perspectives on Juneteenth that he wants to share.
First of all, let me apologize because it'll be in a forthcoming book that should have been published by now, but for the pandemic and lockdown. And secondly, I'll be elaborating on this on your sister station, WBAI, on Juneteenth, 2021. Check your local listings. But let me first of all congratulate Congress for passing this bill, and particularly in entitling it Juneteenth Independence, which is a nod to the 1619 Project, which suggested accurately that 1776 did not lead to abolition of slavery. It led to an exponential increase in enslavement of Africans, contrary to the false propaganda put out on a regular basis by some of our most eminent, quote unquote, liberal historians. I think it's fair to say that January 1st, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation issued by President Lincoln did not apply in Texas or in most of the states of the seceding slave-owning Confederate States of America. And in fact, the kernel and nugget of what I'm talking about today is that the Confederates plan to continue slavery in Texas. That was why when General Granger showed up in Galveston, Texas, a major slave port, on June 19th, 1865, coincidentally enough, he was accompanied by 75,000 so-called colored troops who were there because, recall that there's another holiday in the mix, which is Cinco de Mayo, a Mexican and Mexican-American holiday, which commemorates a Mexican victory over France, which had seized Mexico during the height of the U.S. Civil War. And French-backed Mexico was quite close to the Confederates. And indeed, the idea was not only to continue slavery in Texas, but for Texas to rejoin French-backed Mexico. Recall that Texas had seceded from abolitionist Mexico in 1836 because the president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, in Mexico City, had abolished slavery in 1829, and Sam Houston and Stephen F. Austin weren't having it. So they set up a slave owners republic that was then forced to join the Union in 1845 due to pressure from abolitionist Haiti and abolitionist London. So you need to realize that what happens post June 19th is that the Negro troops, as they were then called, engaged in a hammer and anvil maneuver in conjunction with progressive Mexican forces to squeeze the French-backed forces in Mexico. Actually, Juneteenth is a stirring story of Black-Brown unity as opposed to this tired white savior narrative as represented by General Granger. And that's just a kernel and a nugget of a story that will be in a book that'll be out relatively soon and on WBAI on Juneteenth, 2021.
Okay. I'm glad that you were able to give us a taste of this very complex and profound story. I hope that all of our listeners will correct everybody at the Juneteenth cookout when they have their story about it, and we can have the real story. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
Gerald Horn with WPFW. Horn and James Lowen, who I put together because I met them at the same conference many, many years ago on the U of I campus. Lowen is from Decatur, and turns out Gerald Horn is originally from St. Louis, though Princeton, Columbia, and UC Berkeley are his education. He's now, as you've heard here, or will hear again, at University of Houston. So his piece includes the sort of geopolitical dynamics of the background to the Revolution and the Civil War, even. I've heard some criticisms of Horn's thesis because it somehow takes away agency from the African Americans and the various diaspora blacks that he chronicles, but I don't think so, personally. You can judge that. So here's the long segment, the two books, Negro Comrades of the Crown and the Counter-Revolution of 1776. Wide-ranging, and ends up on Civil War insights at the end of the segment. It's quite a broad scope, and it's hard to edit because things connect so much. I commend your attention to his work.
I'm Mitch Jezrich. Historian Gerald Horn is here. Gerald Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 30 books, including four alone on W.E.B. Du Bois and Shirley Graham Du Bois. His latest book is called Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. It's a book that chronicles slave revolts during the early 19th century and Britain's support of them. His forthcoming book is about the Revolutionary War of 1776 and Africans bounded in slavery. Gerald Horn, it's a pleasure to have you back here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And the upcoming book is called Counter-Revolution of 1776, and this is a prequel to the last book you wrote about the War of 1812.
That is correct. And because this book will shortly be published but is not actually on the stand, let me alert listeners to the fact that there is a summary of the argument in the current issue of Black Renaissance, published by New York University. It's on newsstands now, as we speak.
And they can you get that online?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But certainly you can get online, YouTube, various addresses I've given on this very same topic, presenting a summary of the argument at the North American Labor History Conference in Detroit in October 2012, and the Breck Forum in New York in October 2011, I present a summary of the argument.
Well, I was able to find the previous one you mentioned quite easily just by doing a Gerald Horn search on YouTube. Important to remember that Horn is with an E at the end of it.
Yes. E is silent, I should add.
tell me about what you're doing here with these two books?
Well, with The Counter-Revolution of 1776, as the title suggests, I'm trying to revision the origins of the United States that gives the progressive movement a better understanding of what they're up against. And I should say, to give the descendants of mainland enslaved Africans an idea of what they have been up against and what they are up against as we speak. In other words, I don't necessarily see, as previous commentators and historians have, that 1776 was this great lurch of progressivism, this great step forward for humanity. I analogize 1776, quite frankly, to UDI in Rhodesia, Unilateral Declaration of Independence in Rhodesia in November 1965. Just like UDI was an attempt by a settler class, a European settler class in Africa, to evade the logic of decolonization by declaring independence, 1776, as I argue, was an attempt by a settler class to evade the logic of abolition. I start the book by going to the courtroom in June 1772, where Somerset's case is being decided. You may recall this is the case that tends to suggest that abolition is on the way in the British Empire. This case is reacted to very negatively, to use a euphemism, in North America, in the 13 colonies, so-called. And from there, I talk about how you can draw a straight line from this idea that abolitionism may be coming to the empire to the revolt of 1776.
Well, tell me, what is the Somerset case?
Well, it's a case about an African, an enslaved African who's taken to London by his American, quote-unquote, slave owner. And then he escapes and then files suit for freedom. And, of course, there's a nascent abolitionist movement in the U.K. There are thousands of Africans, by the way, living in the U.K., mostly in London, in 1772. And they mobilize and they get counsel for this enslaved African. And he winds up winning the case, in a sense. But in order to understand Somerset's case, I think you have to understand some of the prehistory as well. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem with many of our accounts of 1776 is that historians and commentators, they parachute into the decade of 1770s and then take the story from there, which I think is a mistake. Because once the settlers engaged in an armed uprising, of course, their strategy and tactics differ. They make more positive overtures to Africans and Native Americans, et cetera, because they don't want to be killed by the British troops. I start the case in the story in the middle of the 17th century. Basically, with the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, which basically, in many ways, causes a retreat in the powers of the monarchy and an increase in the powers of the merchant class. For example,
and this is called the Glorious Revolution.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what they call it. And I use the term too because
who called it that?
Oh, it's a term that gets started at the time of its launching and has been picked up by historians. C'est la vie. Uh-huh. And this Glorious Revolution, so-called, increases the power of the growing merchant class. And in many ways, what it does, it leads to a deregulation of the African slave trade and an increase in participation of the African slave trade of the growing merchant class, who then descend on Africa like maniacal crazed bees and drag and manacle Africans and take them across the Atlantic to the Americas. This has two consequences. Well, on the one hand, it leads to a skyrocketing of the productive forces in the Americas. Indeed, as earlier historians have suggested, you might be able to mark the launching of capitalism, the takeoff of capitalism from this period, 1688. Mm. But at the same time, it leads to growing instability because, you know, the Africans don't take very well to being manacled, enslaved, and forced to work for free. And so what this leads to is growing instability, particularly in the Caribbean. Keep in mind that up until about the middle of the 18th century, Britain is concentrating more on the Caribbean than on the North American mainland colonies, not least because of the profitability of the sugar trade in Barbados, Jamaica, etc. So what happens is that the Africans launch all of these liquidation plots against the settlers, and they outnumber the settlers quite handsomely. And for example, in 1736, there's this famous liquidation plot the Africans launch in Antigua in the Caribbean. This causes many of the settlers, of course, to decide to find a homeland elsewhere. For example, Abraham Redwood, a leading settler in Antigua, moves to Newport, Rhode Island. And if you go to Newport, Rhode Island today, you can enter a very nice library called the Redwood Library. I did research there. And he was one amongst many who decided that he would be better off seeking his fortune in mainland North America. At the same time, in Jamaica, for example, you have the revolts of the Africans that many in London think presages the collapse of the entire colonial project in Jamaica. Keep in mind that the British had only taken Jamaica in 1655. They took it from the Spanish. And it was not unknown that these colonies could change hands. And it would not have been absurd for some to suggest that it could not only have changed hands, say, from one European power to another, but from a European power to the Africans themselves. In fact, if you look at Cuffy's revolt in the early 1760s in what is now the independent state of Guyana on the northern coast of South America, the Africans, thousands of them, had claimed to have seized power before they were ousted. So because of this unrest amongst...
You have a series of revolts leading up to 1776.
Yes, and now let us get to the revolts on the North American mainland. 1712, Manhattan. 1739, South Carolina. 1741, Manhattan. Then, of course, there are all the other acts of sedition, poisoning, for example. Many of the Africans master the nature of herbs and begin to poison the settlers. And then there are all the arsons that are taking place. Fire is a major weapon of the enslaved that is used promiscuously.
Does all this include the Stono Revolt?
South Carolina, very important turning point. Stono's revolt is one of the most disruptive revolts of the enslaved in colonial North American history. But what I should stress, and what I stress in the book that I don't think historians have stressed sufficiently to this point, is that Stono's revolt was basically a collaboration between the Africans and the Spanish in Florida. The Spanish had been using Africans as soldiers going back to the 1500s. Mm-hmm. In the run-up to Stono's revolt in South Carolina in 1739, many of these African soldiers had been crossing into British territory, so-called, and trying to stir up the Africans. And in fact, after the Africans in South Carolina had massacred some of the settlers, they began to try to march towards St. Augustine in Spanish Florida. Keep in mind as well that this was nothing new. The Spanish had been crossing the border, stirring up the Africans, going back to the latter part of the 17th century. Indeed, 1733 is also a turning point, because in 1733, basically the British decide to establish a pro-slavery, all-white colony in the state of Georgia, which is very curious because, as I understand it, the 2010 census suggests that the state of Georgia and what is now known as the United States of America has one of the largest African populations, if not the largest, in the 50 states. But it was started as a so-called white colony, as a sort of a Berlin Wall to separate South Carolina from Spanish Florida. But of course, it didn't work out very well because the Europeans didn't want to work in the fields. Right. I mean, it's a hard job. And so they had to eventually bring in Africans as well.
Yeah.
So what happens is that with this collaboration between the Spanish and the Africans, this leads the British to wage war against the Spanish and also against the French, because 1712 revolt in Manhattan also tends to indicate French assistance to the Africans as well.
And this is key. It's international assistance.
As a matter of fact, if to fast forward in my preface to the Counter-Revolution book, I say that the old slogan from the 1930s of black and white unite and fight, may need to be supplemented, if not supplanted, by a slogan that takes into account the grand sweep of North American history, which would be Africans here and abroad unite and fight with the assistance of a foreign power, I mean, basically, because I think the progress that we have made over the centuries has come in no small part because of the assistance of foreign powers, be it Mexico in the early 20th century, or Japan in terms of the history of the black nationalism, or the Soviet Union during that era, Spanish, and then the British during the early 19th century, etc. So what happens is that because of this, the British in the so-called Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, seeks to push the French and the Spanish away from its colonies. And they succeed grandly. With regard to the Spanish, for example, they even take over Cuba in 1762. And they do this with the assistance of armed African troops. And there hangs the tale.
Were they slaves?
No. Not all of them. Many of them are free persons. And that's the contradiction, because you're trying to arm Africans basically to defend the slave system. I mean, that doesn't work out very well. I mean, it doesn't take an oracle to figure out that something is going to have to give. And what happens as well is that the British tell these Africans who take over Cuba, or I should say Havana, that you can share in the booty. And this is very upsetting to the settlers. By the way, the British have difficulty in conscripting the settlers who don't want to go to Havana to fight. And then when they do get there, they don't like the idea that they're being treated like slaves, as they would put it. They're being treated like Africans. They can share equally in the bounty. So basically, with the Seven Years' War, Britain achieves a catastrophic victory. That is to say, it pushes its European competitors to a degree out of its immediate territory. Of course, it leads to a historic defeat for the French in Quebec, leaving a national question in Quebec that still lingers. And they push the Spanish out of Florida and take over Florida by 1763. And then they present the bill to the settlers because they say, you know, we did this for you because, you know, the Spanish were coming across the border, stirring up the Africans. The French were coming across the border, stirring up the Africans. So we pushed them out. Now here's the bill. And the settlers, you know, as you know, there's this cultural antipathy to taxes amongst the descendants of the settlers that exist to this day. They didn't want to pay these taxes. And they basically wound up collaborating with the antagonists of London, that is to say, the French and the Spanish, against London, and then oust the British from North America, or at least the 13 colonies, and declare the United States of America. Now, there's the executive summary of a new history of the origins of this country now known as the United States.
And that's important because you call 1776 our understanding of this history right now basically America's creation myth.
Well, yeah. I mean, because basically, as I see it, it all starts in 1688 with the empowering of the merchant class.
And what was called the Glorious...
And the Glorious Revolution.
And what do we mean, Glorious Revolution?
Was
that something that was fought? Was that here?
Well, no, in London, in the UK. Although, of course, it has manifestations in the colonies, because these people are all British subjects that are in the colonies, let's say the Europeans. But what happens, as I argue, is that you have a number of retrograde battles against what could be called a bourgeois revolution of 1688. A retrograde battle against the bourgeois revolution would be 1861, when the Confederate States of America seek to secede from the United States of America and fortunately are squashed. 1836, when Texas secedes from Mexico after Mexico moves to abolish slavery in 1829 under the leadership of a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero. They succeed. Eventually, Texas, as you know, is annexed by the United States after 9 years of independence. And I talk about that in the Negro Comrades book. Mm-hmm. And then I add to that 1776, which I argue is motivated in no small part by the reaction against abolitionism. It's no accident, as historians like to say, that many of the subsequent leaders of this new republic known as the United States of America are slave owners, including Slave owner number one, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams was a lawyer for slave owners, and Andrew Jackson, a slave dealer, and so on and so forth.
This is what we mean by bourgeois revolution. It was a revolution whether we're talking about 1776 or the breaking Texas breaking off of Mexico is for...
Well, what I'm saying is that the bourgeois revolution was basically the attempt to establish capitalism.
Yeah.
And then you have these retrograde reactions, which I argue is this attempt to establish slavery, which is a counter-revolution. It's in terms of the clock of history moving forward. Slavery is a retreat. Indeed, I would make another point that if you look at capitalism and its takeoff, as I argue, from 1688, it takes until 1865 for capitalism to work out the issue of slavery in the United States. Actually, you could make it neat and say it takes until 1888 with abolition in Brazil. So it takes 200 years, basically, for capitalism to discard the fetters, the manacles of slavery, which I think is a cautionary note, in my opinion, when we look at the history of socialism, which obviously has had its ups and downs, shall we say, but whose existence is less than a century, and it may take as long for the socialist project to discard the fetters and the manacles and the handicaps that have scarred that project may take as long as it did for capitalism.
You mean the downsides of what we know about the Soviet Union?
Well, of course. I mean, in terms of the human rights violations, in terms of the other things that, of course, the United States...
Because people are easily reminded of those when we talk about socialism.
Right.
Not so when we talk about capitalism.
Well, and it's a very interesting. I think it's unfortunate for the U.S. left to do that because I think that it leaves many in the black community with the idea that what happened to the Africans in terms of being this involuntary conscripted army enlisted to help capitalism take off by contributing centuries of unpaid labor, that, in the long run, everything worked out. I mean, yeah, you know, there was a little oppression, but hey, you know, everything worked out because this is grand United States of America. Sure, there was dispossession of the Native Americans, and sure, you know, the Africans suffered. But in the long run, everything worked out. Well, what I'm saying is people on the left don't take such a benign, benevolent viewpoint when it comes to the competing history of socialism. There, the downsides are accentuated. And I think that leaves the blacks, particularly in the United States, with the idea that what happened to them is sort of irrelevant or that people don't care, which I think leads to a certain kind of anger, needless to say, and a certain kind of skepticism of their so-called compatriots that share these United States of America, who, in their opinion, don't acknowledge their suffering, in fact, downplay their suffering, not only downplay their suffering, but tend to accentuate the suffering that took place thousands of miles away. And, you know, this is an unsustainable political project as a result.
Again, we are in conversation with Gerald Horn. He holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. You've written more than 30 books, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's still no sign of slowing up on that. But your last two, or I'd say your last book is called The Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. And now your upcoming book is a prequel to that, which is called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. More about this idea about the founding of the Republic and what people like to commonly call it, and I'll put it in quotes here, as the genius of the founding fathers, is that they wrote eventually a constitution, and now we're talking more about the constitutional convention, a document that would, even though you had these great contradictions of slavery and of genocide, that eventually the way that this document was written would lead for people, whether it be Native Americans, African Americans, whoever it may be, towards more equal opportunities in the future?
Well, I'm glad you raised that question because I tackled that question frontally in the preface of the book we're discussing now. The whole idea that they established a template that then could be extended to those who were somehow forgotten with the original draft with regard to, you know, U.S. 1.0. And to me, That's like saying that the apartheid jailers of Nelson Mandela should be given credit for his enfranchisement. Because with the enfranchisement of Europeans who came to South Africa before democracy in 1994, they established a template that could then be extended to the Africans. I mean, obviously that sounds rather ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that that's a common argument in the United States bespeaks the kind of deep hole that we have dug for ourselves in this country, which may help to shed light on why the right wing is so strong in this country, because I think we've given up so much ideological territory to the right wing.
Going back to this,
well, in terms of the lauding of the origins of this slaveholders' republic. Second of all, the Dominican Republic, I argue, is an analog to the United States. How so, you ask? Well, if you look at the island of Hispaniola, you have a true abolitionist revolution in Haiti, 1791 to 1804. Then in the 1840s, you have a secession from Haiti that leads to the formation of the Dominican Republic. Fast forward to the era of Rafael Trujillo, the dictator in the Dominican Republic in the 1930s. He helps to establish a refuge for those fleeing the barbarism of Europe, not least Jewish refugees. But of course, his motives are meretricious in the sense that he's interested in whitening his territory. At the same time, he's massacring dark-skinned people. Now, if you look in the United States, it's sort of an analog. They establish a refuge for those fleeing European barbarism. At the same time, they're massacring indigenous people and Africans. But nobody lauds Rafael Trujillo, even though he established this refuge. But at the same time, the United States is lauded for establishing this refuge. And as I said, this is the kind of territory, ideological territory, that we've given up in this country. If you look at the heralded First Amendment, for example, in order to understand the competition between the European powers in the 18th century, that's the backdrop to the founding of the United States, you have to understand there was something of a religious war taking place between the Protestants and the Catholics, with the Catholic powers, as they were called, being France and Spain, which happens to be the major competitor of the leading Protestant power, which is the UK, the United Kingdom. Now, when you look at the founding of the United States, they're basically taking assistance, particularly from the French. You know, at the Battle of Yorktown, which basically settles for all time the defeat of London in the colonies, in the 13 yeah. colonies, French assistance is huge. It's gigantic. So it's understandable then that in the subsequent constitution that the United States would then move away from the religious Cold War and basically try to establish a kind of First Amendment that would guarantee a kind of religious freedom. But having said that, as Ray Allen Billington pointed out in his book, The Protestant Crusade, that came out decades ago, you still had significant discrimination against Catholics, even despite what I've just said in the succeeding years and decades, with restrictions on Catholics owning weapons, etc. So I think too much has been made with regard, as I said, to this great leap forward for humanity that led to the foundation of the United States of America. And even Edmund Morgan, the now retired Yale historian, in this book, American Slavery, American Freedom, suggested years ago that because of all of this sedition on the part of the African population, oftentimes, I should add, in league with the indigenous population and competing European powers, that the extension of a certain right to the European population in some ways was a defensive measure to lock down their support in the face of this sedition and armed revolt, oftentimes, by the Africans and the indigenous assisted by the Europeans. Instead, what we've received is this idea that these great men, you know, Washington, Madison, yeah. Jefferson, et cetera, they came up with these ideas outside of any kinds of social, political, economic context about extending rights and a Bill of Rights and all of that, without looking at the kinds of contradictions and conflicts that they were facing. And I think that leads to an overestimation with regard to what the progressive movement has to do to overcome And in the book, one of the things I point out is that in some ways, Canada is a control group. That is to say, you didn't have a revolution in Canada. And so if this revolution was so grand, it seems to me you would expect that those who have been disfavored in this country would be disfavored even more in the country that didn't have the revolution. But actually, the opposite is true. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you look at other loyal appendages, so-called, of the British Empire, Australia, whose history is very similar to that in the United States, in Australia, there is a raging debate called the History Wars about the impact of the forcible and violent implantation of white supremacy in Australia. Whereas the United States has a remarkable consensus from left to right on the benevolence of the founding, on the humanitarianism on the founding, the great leap forward for humanity on the founding.
Well, let me ask you this then, and let me preface this by acknowledging that slavery was written into the Constitution, as well as counting Africans who are here as two-thirds of a person. I think there is a common conception that whether it be the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, or even legislative victories during the Civil Rights era 40 years ago, that this would not have been possible, or that somehow it's linked to what happened in that great, what some people call the Great Leap of 1776. You're arguing, would you argue that these things could have happened regardless?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'm arguing is that I don't necessarily see 1776 as this great leap forward for humanity. And second,
right, and I want to recognize that too. I'm just saying I think there's this common perception, though, that these things are connected to that.
Well, I mean, they're connected to the same degree. Well, as I said, if you want to argue that the enfranchisement of Nelson Mandela is due directly to the template established by his apartheid jailers, well, then yes. You can argue that the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, affirmative action, all of that, that's due to the genius of 1776. I mean, yeah, if one wants to make the analogous argument with regard to South Africa, well, yes, you can make that argument. But I think it's hard for me not to chuckle.
But do you think, though, I understand you're chuckling at that notion, and I'm not trying to argue for that perspective. Mm-hmm. But do you think that's a perspective a lot of people have?
Oh, of course. As I said, there's a remarkable consensus, not from left to right. Not only that, but if you look, you know, Ho Chi Minh, for example, after the Japanese are ousted from Vietnam circa 1945, and he tries to establish independence for Vietnam and tips his cap to the Declaration of Independence. V.I. Lenin, in his voluminous writings in the United States, speaks of what happens in 1776 as a grand revolution. And I think that what they're pointing to, in no small part, is the retreat of the divine right of monarchs. Well, first of all, I would say that to put Lenin and Ho in context, you have to take into account, number one, the idea of diplomatic niceties and protocol in terms of dealing with this competing power. Yeah. And number two, particularly with regard to Lenin, I would say that I think Lenin might have overestimated the positive impact on the global correlation of forces by the defeat of the then leading power, that is Great Britain, in the wake of 1776. Because, as it turns out, what happens is that the United States replaces Britain as the leading slave trading power. In fact, extends the slave trade by an order of magnitude. And by basically taking over the slave trade to Cuba and Brazil, basically dwarfing whatever Britain had sought to do. And then there's the other point with regard to the divine right of monarchs. Daniel O'Connell, the great Irish patriot, revolutionary, as I say in the Negro Comrades book, he says, well, okay, you had the defeat in 1776 of the aristocracy of class. Fantastic. But it was basically replaced by the aristocracy of color. And so how can you say that that's a great leap forward for humanity? And then, of course, we have to, at some point, have to get to 2012, 2013, and this power, the United States now, and we see all the havoc that it has created around the world and is continuing to create, and yet it supposedly had this grand revolution. But it's something doesn't fit And I think that those who were interested, sincerely interested in profound transformation of this country, have to go back to the origins and trace the origins in a way that makes the narrative consistent and congruent. Because right now, the narrative doesn't make any sense. Right now, there's the Grand Revolution, then the Native Americans get liquidated, more Africans get enslaved, then is extended to Hawaii, Philippines, Cuba.
Well, I was just thinking of the American-Spanish War of 1898.
Right.
And at first, I imagine in Cuba and the Philippines, the people who were resisting the Spanish at first welcomed the involvement of the U.S., but then that didn't last very long.
Oh, that put it mildly.
And people will call it 1898 sort of one of the jumping stones for U.S. imperialism.
Well, you know, I have a book that'll be coming out on Cuba sometime within the next 13 or 14 months. And the book is entitled Exporting Slavery and Jim Crow, U.S. and Cuba and the Road to Revolution. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I point out is that even during the Spanish period in Cuba, I'm speaking about the period before the abolition of slavery in the 1880s, that already the U.S. had taken over the role as being the chief center for bringing Africans to Cuba. Indeed, you may know that it was in 1862 that one of the few U.S. nationals was executed for the slave trade, and he was bringing Africans from the Congo to Cuba. And Abraham Lincoln, finally sensing that trying to conciliate with the so-called Confederate States of America by looking the other way with regard to their slavery and slave trade transgressions, was basically burying his republic. So he authorized the execution of this chap. Likewise, you mentioned 1898, there's a Cuban surge for independence from the Spanish. The U.S. troops land, including a sizable number of U.S. Negro troops, I should add. And basically, what happens is that instead of Cuban independence flowing, which is what many people thought would happen, basically, Cuba becomes a neo-colony of the United States of America. But not only that, but then a form of Jim Crow, not unlike the Jim Crow that exists in the United States, that is to say apartheid, is implanted in Cuba, which is quite alienating because it had not been in place, at least not to that degree, before. And I argue in this book that this is a step on the road to revolution in 1959.
Yeah.
This forcible implantation of Jim Crow in Cuba, which is very alienating, and so the Cubans then oust the U.S. neocolonialists altogether on January 1st, 1959.
Again, we are in conversation with Gerald Horn. He's a historian. He also holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Again, he's the author of 30 books, and it sounds like you have 30 more already charted out.
A few.
Yeah, a few more after the Cuban book as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. How do you do that? Do you look at a period of history and then map out what you want to dive into? And
well, a couple things. Some of it depends. Since I'm not a novelist, I just can't make things up. I have to usually find an archive.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll stumble across a rich archive and say, I can sculpt this piece of marble into a nice sculpture. For example, the Associated Negro Press, which I'm working on right now, it was a black version of the Associated Press. It had correspondence all over the world from 1918 to the 1960s. Langston Hughes writes for it, the great Harlem Bard. Zora Neale Hurston writes for them.
Yeah.
They have correspondence in Moscow, correspondence in Africa, and they have a voluminous archive. So I said, I should look into this and try to make this into something, which is what I'm doing. Another project I'm working on, after doing all these books on various parts of the world, the South Seas, Africa, Brazil, my book on the deepest South, U.S., Brazil, and the African slave trade, this book on Cuba, I thought it would be interesting to look into how the blacks dealt with outer space. This is the next logical step. Before Sputnik, 1957, when the Soviets and the device into outer space. But I came to find out that there's not enough to write about. But what I did come to find out, which is what I'm working on now, which has sort of seized my imagination, is that the blacks were very much into flight. That in the period before Orville and Wilbur Wright, given credit for inventing the airplane in 1903, that you had Negroes in the United States tried to invent flying devices, which is understandable because how are we going to get out of this place?
Yeah. Right, of course.
And so now I'm writing about flight. And of course, in the great race riot, so-called, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, approximately 90 years ago, when the black community was destroyed, there's credible evidence to suggest that airplanes were used there, along with machine guns, to mow down the Negroes. There's evidence.
And this is just after what's called the Green Corn Rebellion in Oklahoma.
But not only that, but then there's evidence to suggest that in South Africa at the same time, they were using planes and machine guns to mow down the Africans. Same thing in Libya around 1911. So the blacks are very much seized with this idea of that, we have to get into flight and aviation. And so you have a black American by the name of Robinson. After the Italians invade Ethiopia in the 1930s, he's a pilot. He goes there to try to help train the Ethiopians to develop an air force, stays on and helps to develop Ethiopian Airways, which right now is probably the leading carrier on the African continent other than the South African Airways. And when he dies in the 1950s, thousands of Ethiopians come into the streets. So there's a lot to look at with regard to flight, which is what I'm working with now.
And you've also written a number of books on W.E.B. Du Bois.
That's right.
And also Shirley Graham Du Bois. In fact, last time we had you on was to talk about the life and times of W.E.B. Du Bois. But what's also interesting, you've also written about Shirley Graham Du Bois, getting us back to the topic of 1776, is Shirley Graham Du Bois took real issue with the historical characterization of Crispus Attucks.
Well, yeah,
Crispus Attucks was the man who first died in the Revolutionary War, black man.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's a historian at Western Michigan University. His name is K-A-C-H-U-N. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. First name, Mitch, who's written about Crispus Attucks. And one of the things he points out is that Crispus Attucks, as a hero of 1776, that trope in the black community doesn't come to after the Civil War. In other words, I think it might be fair to say, given the pro-London attitudes that Negroes held during the slavery period, that he might have been seen as a chump, before abolition, so-called. And I think one of the things I guess I'm trying to bring forward to you is that the writing of history changes over generations.
Yeah.
I mean,
you brought this forward in our conversation about W.E.B. Du Bois and the history of
Reconstruction. For example.
Yeah.
The period after the U.S. Civil War, which before the publication of W.E.B. Du Bois's massive opus, Black Reconstruction in the 1930s, Reconstruction, the period from 1865 roughly to 1877, was seen as a period of Negro misrule, as represented in the
In the movie.
Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
The Negroes sitting in the legislative assembly, eating chicken bones and throwing them on the floor, picking toe jam out of their toes, et cetera. Raping, plundering, and pillaging.
Yeah. It's also resurrected the history of Thaddeus Stevens.
Well, yeah, who is, of course, receives his just due in the new Lincoln film. By Steven Spielberg. And, there's a saying amongst historians that too often is not observed, which is that every generation really should be rewriting history. And we haven't had that with regard to 1776. The basic narrative has continued for over two centuries now. And I don't think that that's done a service to progress or to progressivism as a whole. I think it's very confusing, as I said, because it doesn't make any sense. The basic narrative line doesn't make any sense that, you had this great leap forward that led to genocide against the Native Americans. I mean,
you had more Africans fight with the British in 1776.
Oh, sure. By an order of magnitude. Understandably. And then, of course, afterwards.
But you don't hear about that.
No. Many of them wound up fleeing to Nova Scotia, for example, in Canada. Many of them wound up returning to Africa, Sierra Leone, subsequently. Some of them moved to London. Actually, I talk about that in my Negro Comrades book. And there's an interesting vignette, I think, in the Negro Comrades book where Edward Blyton, who other than Du Bois could be considered to be the father of Pan-Africanism. Mm-hmm. He's born in what we refer to as the Virgin Islands. But he happens to be in Washington at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed. And he's looking around in the streets seeing shackled Africans. And he's looking around the streets and seeing abused Africans. And he pens a letter at that moment to the leading British politician, William Gladstone. And parenthetically, if you look closely, you'll find a number of older U.S. blacks who carry the name Gladstone.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to Gladstone, well, actually, we owe this Emancipation Proclamation to the pressure that London placed on the Republic with this massive abolitionist movement, which had captured a significant percentage of the British population, which had led to the abolition of slavery in the empire decades before it occurred in the Republic.
Well, that's what I wanted to bring up, though. I mean, the British abolished slavery in the 1830s.
That's correct.
Far after the Revolutionary War of 1776.
That's right. And then, of course, the slave trade was abolished decades before then. And then after they abolished the slave trade, the United States says that it's abolishing the slave trade circa 1808, along with the British. But in fact, what happens, they basically take the place of the British. And they do this despite the fact that as a result of the War of 1812, there is a treaty signed where the United States basically says that it's going to move out of the slave trade. But of course, that doesn't take place. And as I pointed out in this conversation and in previous writings, they basically move to take over the slave trade.
Yeah.
Gerald Horn, Mitch Jezerich, looking forward to Jezerich's interview with him on his upcoming book, which is COVID delayed, and I haven't been able to establish a title to it. Maybe it hasn't been fixed yet. Here he is interviewed again about Juneteenth and the end of the Civil War and implications about the French takeover of Mexico. Some dimension that I had never heard of before.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg with a Juneteenth special to celebrate and commemorate and remind that those who believe in freedom and the realization of the promise of democracy cannot rest until it comes. Joining us now is an author of more than 30 books, Dr. Gerald Horn, who will unearth and lay bare the complex circumstances that surrounded Juneteenth, 1865. As we both applaud the recognition of Juneteenth as a national holiday, which provides us with an opportunity to have a thorough remembrance of this horrific system that was slavery, and for an American reckoning with its legacy of settler colonialism and the development of plantation capitalism. Good Juneteenth, Dr. Horn.
First of all, let me say that I support the recent action that has moved to make Juneteenth a new federal national holiday to mark the abolition of slavery. That is long overdue and well worthwhile. However, the now traditional story of Juneteenth is somewhat problematic and obscures more than it reveals. The traditional story is that General Gordon Granger of the U.S. military showed up in Galveston, Texas, a major slave port, by the way, on June 19th, 1865, and told the enslaved that you're free. And supposedly, they didn't know that. They didn't know about the Emancipation Proclamation. But, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st, 1863, by Abraham Lincoln, only served to free those where the Lincoln government had no jurisdiction. He certainly didn't have jurisdiction in the Confederate state that was Texas. And it was a war-fighting measure. It was meant to spur the enslaved, particularly black men, to join the Union Army, which they did in profusion, and helped to turn the tide, which had been going in the direction of the Confederate forces until they started streaming in the army of the Lincoln government in profusion. What's interesting about Juneteenth as well is that General Granger shows up with 75,000 black troops. Why did he feel that he needed so many? And this gets us closer to the reality of what was going on. The reality is that Texas was less damaged by the U.S. Civil War than any other slave state. Texas, in some ways, was the keystone of the arch of the attempt to overthrow the U.S. government and extend slavery forevermore. In the aftermath of the so-called surrender of the Confederates in April 1865, the idea of the Confederates was to regroup in Texas. When Jefferson Davis, the president of the so-called Confederate States of America, was captured fleeing Richmond, the capital. He was en route to Texas, accompanied by a man by the name of Francis Lubbock, who, of course, his name has been bequeathed to Lubbock, Texas, a major West Texas metropolis. The idea was that Texas would not only seek to continue the war, but it would then join French-controlled Mexico. During the U.S. Civil War, the French opportunistically had seized Mexico. I'm sure you're familiar with the Mexican-American holiday Cinco de Mayo, 5th of May, which marks a major victory over the French troops in Mexico. Texas had seceded from Mexico in the first instance in 1836 in order to extend slavery, because Mexico, under president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, had moved to abolish slavery. And Sam Houston, Stephen F. Austin, and the other pro-slavery comrades were not having it, so they set up an independent state, the Lone Star Republic, which became a major slave trading nation during its brief existence from 1836 to 1845. The Lone Star flag could be found off the coast of Angola, the coast of Brazil, the coast of Cuba. If you look at your map, there's a straight shot from Galveston to Cuba, and many Africans were transshipped from Galveston, Texas, to Cuba as late as 1860. You had hundreds of Congolese being smuggled improperly and illicitly into Galveston. But what happens is that independent Texas could not take the pressure from revolutionary Haiti and its allies in the abolitionist movement, not least in London, and it crawled into the Union in 1845, where it's been ever since. The idea was to rejoin French-backed Mexico and then extend slavery to take more enslaved Africans south of the border. During the U.S. Civil War, since Texas was the least damaged of the slave-owning states in neighboring Louisiana, its central city, New Orleans, had been seized by the Lincoln government early in the conflict. So you had slave-owning forces from Louisiana, from Arkansas, et cetera, who were bringing, quote, their, unquote, Africans into Texas. So the Texas enslaved population was growing spectacularly and exponentially during the U.S. Civil War. The idea was to drag them into Mexico, where the decree of the 1820s, which had abolished slavery, would be overturned, and slavery would receive an extended lease on life. The idea was for the 75,000 black troops to be sort of a guarantor that that would not happen, because the Lincoln government, they were poor sociologists in the sense that they had this idea that blacks were better fighters, but they didn't apparently realize that that was because of a hundred of years tradition in North America, where if you were a black soldier and you were defeated on the battlefield, you were enslaved. And so that gave these black soldiers quite an incentive to fight with ferocity. So what happens is that the U.S. government set up these 75,000 black troops as sort of an anvil on the border with Mexico, and then the anti-French forces in Mexico, led by Benito Juarez, who, as you know, the city that's the twin city of El Paso, Texas, Ciudad Juarez, is named after him. He was the leader of so-called liberal Republican forces in Mexico. They were the hammer. And so the French-backed forces were caught between the anvil of the U.S. so-called colored troops on one side and the forces of Benito Juarez pressing from the other side. And so Juneteenth, in some ways, is a story of black-brown unity that defeats French colonialism, but somehow it's morphed into a kind of white savior narrative where Gordon Granger shows up and tells the Negroes, you know what, you people are free.
Dr. Gerald Horn, thanks for gracing us on this first nationally recognized Juneteenth.
Longtime advocate and fighter for social justice, attorney Mimi Rosenberg, host and producer of Equal Rights and Justice Radio, WBAI, New York.
So, a lot of Gerald Horn for 4th of July weekend. Thanks for listening. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I'll give it over to Radio Free Labor and perhaps a little underwriting announcement that might be appropriate for this top of the hour. Thanks again for supporting community media. Thanks for listening. Be safe. Ew.